Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I think this is the sixth night, and this is the first of four streams tonight. In 2 hours from now, I'll have the Fergan on, then Vico Hesler, and then Black Pilled. But first, it's the Woodlander. Now, some of you will already know of the Woodlander. I'm sure a lot of you will. I discovered his channel it was through Morgoth shared one of his videos, and it was just after last millennial. I think it was like in January or maybe February. And I remember being really annoyed because if I discovered him a couple of months earlier, I would certainly have invited him on last year. So I'm glad that he's agreed to appear this year. Would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
I will. Kind of only been on YouTube for just over a year now, so just after your last millennial. And I've been on quite a lot of streams, but I don't stream myself. I tend to just do a video maybe once, twice a week. And I talk about going off grid, which is how I live, and I also talk about society and as I see it, which kind of ties in because that's the reason I went off grid. I'm in my mid-50s, should have done this a lot earlier, which I'm sure we'll get on to. And yeah, it's been an interesting journey, and the people I talk to has been interesting as well, because it's a cross section from left, right, old, young. And what I found over the last year is that actually I'm not the only person that thinks this way, that thinks that actually this could be an answer, not only on a personal level, which it was for me, to withdraw and step aside from a society that and a system that I didn't see it working, but actually on a larger scale to maybe build something different with groups of people. So over the last year, that's basically what I've been doing. That's pretty much it.
I think in one of those, could you mute, because there's this unfortunate echo. Thank you. I think in one of those early videos that I saw, you mentioned September. Like you mentioned putting up a video in September, and I'm guessing that's like last September. So I think you had already started when I was doing Last Millennial, but I didn't. I don't know. You'll know better than I do when you started. But either way, I didn't know of you last millennial. And when I first discovered, it's interesting what you say about that you make one or two videos a week. Because one of the things that struck me when I discovered your channel was that it reminded me of my early work. It reminded me of the attitude, not so much the tone of my early work, but the attitude that I had in those early days, which was that I just didn't really care. There were no expectations. It was just sort of exploring it, doing a video here, sometimes doing a video there, and seeing what worked. And your early videos were like that. And you're still doing it as well. You're still, sometimes you'll do a video in the car. Sometimes you'll do it in the house, usually outdoors. So there's that nice sense of, I don't know what the word is here, but not curiosity even, but just testing things out, experimentation, which is nice to see, because it quickly becomes formulaic when you have a YouTube channel, and it also quickly becomes the weight of viewers' expectations. Like, they don't expect a video from your car, so you don't do one.
It's kind of not just that either. As you're doing this stuff and you're making videos and you want people to watch them, so if you do one that more people watch, you're looking at where did I do it and how did I do it and how did I sound? And I'm kind of trying not to do that, I really am. And I tend to do it in the same spot, because otherwise I'm going to be invaded by chickens or turkeys. So I've got this little place where I can just sit in the woods and do one. And sometimes they do spot me and they come down and they're like walking around, and which is kind of nice, but I haven't got 120 of them doing it, which I would have in some places. And the other thing is, you're quite right. I don't care. I have no... I didn't start this to make money, which would be a completely different thing. I didn't start this to become popular. I'm too old for that. I've got my family and my friends, and I didn't do this to become famous. I did this because I actually thought there were some things that I could, one, I could help people with, and two, there were some things that needed to be said. And I thought, well, I'll say them. And I'll say them with a cup of coffee, and I'll say, welcome to the woods, and this is what I see going on. If you agree with me, great. And if you don't, that's great as well. Now, what's been weird is that whilst a lot of people have been shut down and banned and had restrictions for medical inaccuracies, I've managed to sail through that. Now, I don't know if that's because I'm really small or just because I've done it in the right way, but I haven't tried to change words. I haven't tried to change the word vaccination into jibby jab or Big Mac or whatever. I just haven't. I've just said, look, if you're vaccinated, you're vaccinated. If you're not unvaccinated. And I've expected a few times that maybe I would get an email from YouTube, but I haven't ever. And yeah, that kind of puts me in good stead.
Right, right. You mentioned that you've got a family. I think that it would be interesting, briefly, before we get into the off-grid stuff, which is obviously what we're mainly going to be talking about, it would be interesting to know about what your life prior, like what I think you have had quite a full life from the things that I've heard you say elsewhere. Obviously, I don't want to know the details or the whatever. Just briefly summarize all the jobs you've done and so on.
Okay, well, I've done a lot. So my first business was when I was 13. I started a sign writing business while I was still at school. I was very into art at school. And I was trying to look at ways I could make money out of it. And I saw a business, his sign was all peeling. And I said, do you want it redone? And he said, yeah, how much? And I said, 100 quid. And he said, yeah, fantastic. So I got a ladder and me and my mate and a screwdriver. And we took his sign down. We carried it back to my mum's house. We put it in the garden. We rubbed it down. I masked it all up. I repainted it, took it back down to him the following week and got £100. Which doesn't sound like a lot today, but if you think back then, my pocket money was a fiver. £100 was enough to buy a car back then. It was like, wow, man, this was like a big thing. But that was when I was 13. But I went through school and I went to art college. And I came out of art college.
That's an interesting thing in itself, though. The fact that you had the initiative, because I think it's relevant to what you're doing now. For a 13-year-old to have the initiative to do something like that is quite unusual. And it shows that you were already thinking, even at that very young age, you were thinking, how can I interact with my environment in a way that benefits me and is useful?
I was, but it was kind of a necessity because I was what... I don't even know. I've never heard this term used before, but I was what is known as a fast developer. And I mean, like, so when I was in the first year at school, like my voice broke and like other things happened, and all of my mates when I was 12, 13 were 16. So I got on much better with older lads than I did kids my own age. And 16, 17-year-olds were going down the pub, going away at weekends, and I was kind of hanging around with them. And God bless them, my parents were bright enough to understand that I was beyond my years. So didn't hold me back, but kind of put some restrictions in place and said, listen, we need to know where you are, we need to know where you're going, but we're not going to stop you. So I was hanging around with these older kids. So although my pocket money was a fiver, these lads were earning money. They were working. So I had to, if I was going to go away for a weekend or if I was going to go down the pub at 13, I needed some money. So it was kind of a necessity. So
right.
That's
okay.
Why that came about.
Right. Okay. And then you said art college, and this is obviously something that I would want to talk to you about. Because, you know, there is a question about why anyone goes to art college, especially looking at it in retrospect. Why did you go to art college?
Well, this is a weird thing, right? Because I really liked school. Most of my mates didn't like school. They were bunking off. And like, truant was rife. But I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the learning aspect of it. I had a schizophrenic school life. So the teachers either hated me, which is fine, and I was caned daily, like literally every day, or suspended. I was never expelled, but I was suspended for smoking at school. So I was one of these, the bad kid. But a lot of the teachers really respected me because actually I did buckle down, I did do the work, and I wasn't the brightest kid, but I did always try. And I loved learning. But what I was best at was art, and I knew that. So I kind of figured out quite early on, if that was what I was good at, there was no point me going taking a course in English or whatever. What I should do is concentrate what I was best at. And that's why the signwriting thing started, because I figured, okay, I'm going to have to make some money out of art. And then I went to art college. And the first one was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. I actually learned something from it. But I then went on to a second art college after that, which was dire, absolutely dire.
What was the difference? What did the first art college do that the second one didn't?
Okay. So the first art college was really old, and it was in an old town, and it was in an old building, and it had old left-wing tutors, but they actually took the time to talk about how you could draw and how you could paint and how you can construct stuff. And I learned something. And when I moved on from there to a second art college, which was actually part of another university with a lot of other things going on. So the tutors had no input. They would come in, they'd give you a piece of work to do, I'll see you in 2 months, and there was no learning, there was no teaching, and you would get butted in by tutors from other courses who had no idea what was going on. It was an actual nightmare, and in the end I left. I passed and I got a degree in graphic design, but only because of the coursework I'd done, because I left nearly a year early. Because in the end, I just could not stand it. The first art college was actually really cool, but even there, I was kind of an outsider. Now, you'll understand this. You went to art college. I had a number one crop, 14 old Dr. Martens, and jeans and a bomber jacket, and I was a skinhead. So for me to turn up when everyone was smoking dope and long hair and talking about communism was like, I was like completely on the outside. But actually, that didn't do me any harm. They didn't try to convert me at all. Unlike Dangerfield and probably yourself that have this stuff coming at you, they completely left that out for me. They just concentrated on the art. I was like, I'm only here for this. This is all I want. Don't try anything else. And that's what I got, which was brilliant.
My own experience is a bit different because I was fairly left-wing when I was at art college. And actually, it's my degree thesis was I'm going to do a reading of it for the channel next year. I'm going to read it because I got the only copy that remains of it. I got hold of it and I'm going to read the whole thing out. It's a long document. It'll be several videos. And it's going to really startle some people. How radically different my thinking was at the age of 21 than it was at the age of 31 when I started my channel, because I was really into utopianism, and a type of communism, I guess. I certainly wouldn't have used that word for it at the time, because at the time I was an outsider in the sense that I was aware of mass immigration, aware of that multiculturalism didn't work. That became apparent to me at the very start of art college. But in every other way, I was a complete liberal. So it's going to be strange for people to see when I do that reading. And I haven't read the document, the thesis, since it was written in 2004. So it's going to be weird for me as well. But yeah, in some ways, I definitely didn't fit in. And it's weird to say that you didn't even fit in art college. You're an outsider even at art college, you know, because art college is full of weirdos, but and you know, misfits and whatever. And some, so you could be an outsider there because you're more normal than them. I don't know. I think I was an outsider for honestly because I was a bit more serious than a lot of them. A lot of them were just smoking dope, or they were dreamers and not serious about art, not really serious, not much integrity. Like one thing I noticed was that the ones who did well were not the ones who had talent. It was the ones who were good at selling themselves. So if you had a passion and like a devotion to beauty, for example, everyone else would just laugh at that. You know, that would just be mocked. Art college by then, well, art the culture of the art community in Britain by then had become very postmodern, sarcastic, knowing, and so on. And that was another reason I just didn't feel that I fitted in.
I know, and it's a great shame, isn't it? Because it could be such a great environment. And when it worked, when I was being taught about art and beauty and how they constructed paintings and how to pull that out of antiquity and put it into modernity was incredible. And I had some great tutors and I had some great art teachers, but few and far between. And that's an actual shame. And the way the art colleges, well, nowadays, there are no art colleges. They're just all part of a university. And I've seen how that works. And that is just diabolical.
That's true. I went to two art colleges. The first one was Cumbria Institute of the Arts. It was called Cumbria College of Art and Design when I was there. Then that it was in Carlisle, and then it became Cumbria Institute of the Arts, and then it's now part of a nearby university. It's been absorbed into that nearby university, so it's no longer its own institution anymore. And then from there, I transferred to Chelsea College of Art and Design in London, which was part of a consortium of art, a confederation of five art colleges, which was called the London Institute. Collectively, they were called the London Institute, which I really liked that name. They changed it. They're now called University of the Arts London. which I think doesn't sound nearly as nice as the London Institute.
I don't really know what to say, because not only does it not sound nice, you kind of seen what's happened. They've taken something that used to be separate, which was art, right? And they've just smashed it in with fashion and science and technology and everything. And it's not. It's a completely separate, which is why you used to have. You would have a university that taught all these other subjects. And then you would have a completely separate institution that taught people art.
Yeah.
And it's the only way you can do that. But, I mean, I think we need to just bow our heads for the moment and go, that's gone. That's gone now. Now, we might be able to bring it back, but at the moment, it's gone.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we can have romantic, and I think it is nice to have romantic notions about it, because, you know, what else is life about? If you can't be romantic about these things, it's nice to think of what it could be and what it once was. I mean, I have a similar feeling about the BBC. I think the BBC was probably once upon a time, yes, it would have been full of insufferable loveys and whatever, but still it would have been a very creative place. Like, and you hear about these agreements that were struck in the BBC canteen, and then a great drama was produced because two guys had a drink together. You know, it must have been so fun. But anyway, with art college, yeah, I think it does need to be separate from the universities per se, because for a start, you just need a completely different environment. It needs to, it's not academic as such. It's you need a rather hands-on sort of environment, the tools that are needed, the workshops, that kind of thing. But also, I think academically, it's yeah, it depends on the course you're doing, but a lot of the time you won't need any academics or academic input. But yeah, I think you're right that it ideally would be its own thing. It's the same with music colleges, of course. But yeah, all of this, I don't know. I guess you could say this is something endemic in our society, just now, that everything gets merged together. Everything gets smashed together for, you know, centralization, streamlining. There's no need for Cumbria Institute of the Arts to be its own thing. It can just be a wing of this bigger thing. Yeah, there is no need for it. But once you do that, it's sort of like the death knell.
This is kind of the reason. This is part of the reason that I live the way I do, because for a long time I was politically involved, so I was trying to change things that I saw were wrong through politics, and I started off with fringe politics. So I started off with right wing fringe political organisations, and after a couple of decades, kind of came to the conclusion that this was as much as it might be fun running around and waving flags and everything, that actually there was very little chance that they were going to be changing anything. So I moved into mainstream politics on the right, and to see if it would be possible to move a right-wing party, the Conservative Party, further to the right. At a time I thought it needed to, but then became completely disenfranchised with that as I became further up in that organisation within the Conservative Party, to see how it operated, and that actually there was very little difference between the right wing in British politics and the left wing in British politics and the centre. That there was basically no difference.
So somebody the other night said that the Conservative Party in Britain is basically just a they don't really believe in anything. Conservatives, they're just seeking power. They're just working out how to maintain power.
Yeah, but it was weird when I joined a specific time, which was when Blair got into power. Now, because I'd been politically active, I'd been watching Blair for about 3 or 4 years before he actually came to power, and knew exactly what was going to happen if he did. So now I had a choice, because this bloke was going to be really dangerous to this country, which was, we obviously had to get Labour out. And there was no way, right, that the BNP or the National Front they weren't even on the scope of being able to do that. The only party at the time that was capable of it was the Conservative Party, which I didn't like, but they could at least get Blair out. But they needed to move to the right. So when I joined the Conservative Party, my idea was, can this party be moved to the right? Because if it can, I've got a lot of contacts that maybe I could get into this and move it further to the right. Now, the weird thing is, on a grassroots level, the Conservative Party is more right-wing than most people I'd met in the BNP. So the constituency, the people there, are extremely right-wing. But the average age is 72 when I joined. The average age of the Conservative constituent was 72. So I was sat in these meetings in my 30s. Surrounded by geriatric, and I was like, what on earth are you doing? The Labour Party with Blair had pulled in millions of young people. And I was like, look, you're going to have to change something. You're going to have to change what you're doing. And I was going to these conservative suppers, on a weekly basis, and eating a nice lasagna with, 65-year-olds. And I was like, look, you've got to change this. You're not doing anything apart from moaning yourselves and not talking to anyone.
It's really interesting. Because I can remember that era when William Hague became the Prime Minister, not the Prime Minister, the leader of the Conservative Party, and then I think it was Ian Duncan Smith. I can't remember all the people that they went through. It was a quick succession of people. I think it was William Hague at that time who was up against Blair in 97. And prior to that, it had been John Major, who was, dull. Yeah, I mean, Spitting Image famously had him as just grey. His whole, everything was grey. I think that the Conservatives were in this position where they just had they had no idea how to appeal to young people. And I don't really know why that was. I mean, it might well be to do with what Tony Blair had done. He just jettisoned any traditional sort of morality. He was gay friendly. He was a feminist. He was pro mass immigration. A lot of people probably had never heard the word multicultural before until 97. But he was part of bringing that in a big way. And so they had a suite of new ideas, relatively new ideas, new to the mainstream. Whereas the Conservatives had nothing. And that they had no vision at all, no social vision, no cultural vision. They just like things to go back to how they were, if you don't mind. Or you do mind. Oh, right.
The weird thing is, right, that the constituents knew exactly what they wanted. They did actually want things to go back. They wanted to conserve something. It's only as you work your way up into the MP area that you actually find that they didn't want things to go back the way they were. In fact, they were quite happy with Tony Blair. And if they hadn't have been, they wouldn't have been having a beer with his colleagues and with him in the pub. They wouldn't have been eating meals together. They wouldn't have been having meetings together and discussing things. There would have been them like animosity. There was none. None of I that suppose, at the upper I, levels.
I suppose I'm thinking about MPs like Alan Clark, who actually were like real old farts and conservatives and whatever. Of course, the younger ones were, yeah, this was famously said that there really isn't much difference between left and the Labour and Conservative at this point. But Labour are more slick. Labour are more cool. And apparently they seem more competent, whereas the Conservatives seem dull and incompetent and not slick. I mean, you said before that you'd been watching Tony Blair for 3 or 4 years before the 97 election, and you were worried about what did you perceive in Tony Blair prior to him, you know, all of that?
Okay, well, the main thing wasn't what Blair said, right? Because he never said, I'm going to open this country up to immigrants, ever. And he never said, I'm going to push a LGBT, which didn't even exist then, agenda. Right? But if you look at what he was trying to do, which was clothe himself in a conservative cloak, and what he did talk about was the destruction of the UK. His main thing was devolution in Scotland and Wales to get those off, further integration with Europe, and allowing markets to open up. So it sounds very, very conservative. When I say conservative, it sounds very, very...
late 80s, early 90s conservative.
Yeah, exactly that. But actually, it was quite blatant what he was going to do, which was open the borders completely to everyone, not just Europe, but every other nation as well. And destroy the country. What he wanted to do was destroy the UK. He wanted Scotland gone. He wanted Wales gone. He wanted Ireland to be its own nation state. I mean, he had a lot of fingers. He felt the hand of destiny upon his shoulder, apparently, or whatever. The bloke was just a snake, and it was plain to see. So when he came to power, it was obvious that we needed to get shot, and there was only one group that could do it, sadly, which is why I joined that group. But as I progressed through that and was put forward, sat on the European Committee and organised the Young Conservatives, and then started a new group, the 30s, the 40s group, ran the business club for the Conservatives, all these different things I was asked to do. And then put forward as like, okay, next year, do you want to run as an MP? This year, we'll put you forward as a councillor. You won't be elected, but it will get your name on the ticket for an MP next year. I had to say no. I had to say, man, this is much worse than even I that had been reading Colin Jordan and John Tyndall and that knew that you were bad. This is so much worse because actually you don't care. You do not care. And as you worked your way up, you saw it. You actually saw that these people were one group, that Labour, Conservative and Liberal were one group, that were taking some information from somewhere, but they weren't separate. They were one group. And that's kind of when I withdrew from politics and decided that, okay, if I can't change the system through politics, then maybe I have to change the way I interact with the system, which is what led me to the way where I am now.
Before we get that to that, which it was supposed to be the only thing we talked about, but we've ended up going on these tangents, but I don't think anyone will mind. Around the same time that you were trying to make the Conservative Party more right-wing and make it wake up to the reality of things, another man was trying to do the same thing, and that was Jonathan Bowden. Did you ever encounter him?
Yeah, but not at that time and not in the Conservative Party. I actually, like, I didn't meet him. I didn't ever got to speak to him, but I did see him speak at a BNP meeting after that. I was still politically aware. So I did turn up at some events. I did go and see things, both mainstream and fringe, because you need to take information from everywhere. So yes, I did see him speak, which was something else. He was quite an orator. But, you know, I wish I had got to meet him. And I think he came to the same conclusion I did when he tried to do it.
Yeah, I think he did.
Which was at grassroots level, you can do it. You can move a constituency to the right, but as you work your way up that ladder, you'll find that actually there's powers that are nothing to do with that organisation that are controlling it. And it's one group. It's one group of, we might as well just say that they are politicians. It doesn't matter what party, they are just politicians. And they're interchangeable. And that's what's been happening. Even though we were told that again and again and again, until you see it with your own eyes. And it was a massive kick in the bollocks for me, I've got to be honest, right? Because I actually still held some, although I'd been told that you know, other people run it and they're all the same. Until you see that, until you see enemies sitting down and eating a meal together, who 10 minutes earlier had been rowing over policy, but now are best mates. And you suddenly realise, actually, this is all a facade. This is all a game.
Theatre.
All theatre. All of it.
Right. Two other questions about this. You said that, well, I think that you once said that you had experience of left-wing party, and you've just said that. But did you once say that you'd voted left in the elections? Or is that something I've dreamt?
No. What I actually said was I've flirted with fascism and had a dalliance with communism.
Right,
yeah, I think that was it. But I never voted left. I was always on the right. But there comes a time if you're a right winger, and now for me this happened really early on, because I was quite right wing at sort of 13, 14, which is unusual, but not unheard of. But as I got a little older, I started to think that, you know, maybe there was a more social aspect. So, and you do have to think about these things. I remember buying Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto and reading both. And boy, were they hard work. Especially the Communist Manifesto. I've never, ever, ever read a tome with as many contradictions, page after page of contradictions, that made it nearly impossible to get through. But I read it and
I haven't read Das Kapital, but because I heard that it's a lot of work. It's a very big thing. And I think he was working on volume two when he died. That is only, what you see is only volume one. But anyway, I haven't read it. But I have read the Communist Manifesto. I think when I was about 14 or something, it was for a project at school. And I remember just finding it so incredibly boring. Like huge paragraphs, huge, like there's no sympathy for the human condition there. Not even in the text, but also in the presentation of the text, you know, it's robotic, awful. And I think it's only like 50 pages long or something, but God, it feels like a lot more.
But if you read those 50 pages and actually look for it, page one contradicts what's on page three, and page five contradicts what's on page... And I was like, well, you can't say one thing and then pull it back again on an... It was just insanity. It really was. But I did try, because my father was kind of a centralist, and always taught me, right, you need to look at both sides. Like, don't ever make up your mind after only looking at one side. And I always did, and he was always dead right. So I did look at both sides, and then I made up my mind that the right was far more advanced than the left. You know, but I had to adhere to what I'd been taught by my dad, and bless him, he was dead right. Look at both sides, learn from both sides, and take from both sides. And I still do. There's still things from socialism that I think, do you know what? They've got a point. They have got a point. You can't be completely fascistic, right, and completely materialistic, right? You can incorporate ideas and ideology from different areas. And if you're able to do that, then, you know, there's a way forward. If you're completely cut off and completely closed-minded, then you stand very, very little hope of moving forward.
Yeah, and your ideas become very brittle as well, because you're not dealing with reality anymore. You're just speaking from a very doctrinaire, ideological sort of position. And as soon as you meet with reality, you know, all of your constructions can just crumble. You build up resilience by interacting with the other side and with reality. Another question I wanted to ask you, you said that conservative voters were very right wing, and that they did want to conserve things. And you said, forgive me if maybe this wording isn't completely correct, but you said they wanted to go back. They wanted to turn the clock back. But is that ever possible, do you think? Or do you think it's as soon as... Because I think that as soon as you're talking about, can we just turn the clock back? I think you've already lost. I think I think it's impossible. I've got nostalgia for the 80s, the 90s, the 70s, and then far back the Victorian era, the 20s. I've got nostalgia for all sorts of things. But I know that these things are gone, and we can't turn the clock back. And it's sad, but you know, that's my own view. What would you say?
Well, firstly, it wasn't conservative voters, it was the constituents. So that's members of the Conservative Party, which is a very, very small proportion of the population that join a political party. But they were older. So, yeah, they really did. And nostalgia's strong. That's a powerful thing. And these people remembered a time. They actually lived through a time that was better. And for them, it was really easy. They were like, do you know what? I remember when it was better. Similar to when you can talk, like you did earlier, with Black Pigeon Pilled about... not that much, but I'm sorry about that. About how it used to be on the internet, how good it used to be. When you remember that, and now you see what it is like, would it be fair to say that you it would be fair to say that you'd say, I would rather it was like it used
to
be.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's what they were saying. They were literally saying, I remember a time when things were better, and I think it would be better for us if we could get back there. But I think you're right. I don't think we can go back.
In this case, I was only talking about turning the clock back 5 years. But you're right, probably even that is impossible because all the forces pushed in this direction.
Of course. But what we can do is learn. We can see how things used to be. We can learn from that. But we can take how things are moving forward and definitely integrate the two. That I get a lot of pushback from people saying that I shouldn't be so into technology, like, because I'm a big supporter of technology. I think technology is actually a tool. Now, a tool can be used for good or it could be used for bad. It's a tool. A lot of people just see it as a bad thing, and maybe we should get rid of technology and just live a simpler life. And I get that. If they watch in my channel and it's about off-grid living, they're like, yeah, but maybe you shouldn't be using a smartphone and the internet. And I'm like, do you know what? This serves a purpose. And I can use it for my benefit. Are there downsides? Definitely. But I think the upsides for me outweigh the down. Solar panels are technology. My generator is technology. The inverter and batteries are technology. And I use those for my good. I use them to help me. They're not helping anybody else. Maybe it helped the people who made the batteries or the solar panels when I had to buy them. But, that's life. But they're helping me. So I've got nothing against technology. Nothing against it at all. And I think the right should be looking at how can we use technology, not get rid of it, not move out of it, but how can we use this to our advantage? Because it's not going away. In fact, it's going to advance. So we're either going to be in it and advancing it ourselves, or you get left behind. Now, either one I'm quite comfortable with. Like, literally, I am. I mean, I like technology. When I moved in here, I had no electricity at all, no running water. And I lived for a year without electricity, apart from a generator, which I ran for 2 hours an evening, so I could charge my phone up, have a bit of light. But I lived with a log burner and bottled water and a little gas stove to put a kettle on. So that wasn't bad. I quite enjoyed that experience. But it's quite nice now. I've got central heating and I can have a shower. And, electric light.
Yeah, well, I've just realized all the things that we were going to talk about. We're going to talk about the jobs you've done, the businesses you've done. We're going to go into all that, but we got waylaid. So let's get to the off-grid thing then, because I think that is what people want to, they would expect me to ask you about that, and I always expected to ask you about that. First of all, why? Let's go into the why you did, well, why people in general, why you think people in general should do this? Well, first of all, what is off-grid, just so that people know?
That's a huge one. Like I consider myself off-grid. I'm not plugged into the electricity grid. I'm not plugged into the water grid. I'm not plugged into the gas grid. And what else aren't I plugged into? Well, I'm not plugged into anything, really. So my electricity comes from solar and a generator. combined and a battery pack, and that powers my house. Gas, I use LPG, which everyone knows about. You can buy big canisters, little canisters, whatever, and that powers my cooker, my hob, and my central heating. And water, I collect rainwater, I store that, and then I run that through a filter system and then into the cabin. So I've got running water. So I'm not paying money to an electricity company or a gas company as such. I do buy the LPG. Or a water company. I'm not paying these big organizations. I'm not paying a council. With rubbish, I take my recyclable waste to the rubbish tip, which is down the road. I recycle the rest at the recycling center. And any wood or paper or whatever is burnt. So that it works as fuel. I'm kind of off grid. I'm off grid more than most because I don't have a bank account. I haven't had for over 15 years now. That was one of the first things I got rid of. So I only use cash. Pretty untraceable because I'm not registered anywhere. So, but trust me, that doesn't mean they can't find you. They will. But yeah, so I'm kind of off grid. I live in the middle of the woods. My woods, I bought them. I bought two and a half acres of woodland and I built a home. And yeah, that's me being off grid.
Okay, so that if that's the definition of it, so then why do you think people should do this? Why would you recommend it? I mean, obviously, that it might be obvious, but let's go through it anyway.
Yeah, and that's again a massive. It's another hour we could talk, but I won't. I'll cut it down. Okay, why should you do it? You shouldn't, right? You really shouldn't, unless you're unhappy with the way you're living and the system you're living in, and then maybe you should look at it. Which is what I got to, and I was like, I don't want to interact with this. I want to be. I want to get away from it. So I now have a 4-bedroom home in 2.5 acres of land. And I don't have a mortgage. And I don't pay rent. And my bills are probably less than most people spend on petrol in a week. And that's it. So whatever I earn now is mine. And how can you do that? And why is that a good thing? Because it gives you options. Now I have many more options than what I had before this. And I lived in a 3-bedroom house, a semi-detached house with my wife and my kids. And now we live here. But I managed to do this without borrowing money. I managed to do this over a period of time. A little bit at a time. I saved up to buy the land. I didn't borrow the money to buy the land. I saved. We didn't go out to eat. We didn't go on holiday. We didn't have takeaways. We didn't have Netflix. We didn't have any of that for years. Why? Because all the money I earned went in a bag at the bottom of my bed. And then when we found the right bit of land, and for 2 years we drove around, all around the country looking for the right bit of land. And when we found it, I didn't have enough money. So I had to borrow £5,000, which was a nightmare for me. But I borrowed £5,000, not from a bank, but from an individual. And then I spent the next 6 months working double time, like, to pay that money back so that within 6 months I could then start putting my money into building here. But you can do it if you want to. Do you want to be debt free? Do you want to have no mortgage and no rent? Do you want to live a life where you can have animals and be self-sufficient? So I do grow, not all of it, please. Trust me, if I want a steak, I've got to go and buy it. I've got no cows, right? But we keep chickens and we keep turkeys. So I've got eggs coming out of my ears, right? My missus loves animals. We've got seven dogs, all rescue dogs. They're all insane. They're the bane of my life. I've got a German Shepherd that escapes daily. My fence started off at 3 foot, and now it looks like, if anyone's ever watched King Kong, when they come across that fence at the beginning, and yeah, now that's what's round half of the woods now, just so she can't escape. It's but that's life, and I find that enjoyable. Do you know what I mean? It's all good. It's all fun. I chop wood to heat my house, and is that hard work? Yes, it is. Yes, it is hard work. Right. But even that, otherwise I'd have to spend 50 quid on a gym membership or whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's all good.
What you said about the bills and how all of your bills are probably add up to less than the average person spends on petrol in a week. I think that perhaps people don't realise how much money they spend just to stay afloat, just to stay part of the system. That seems like, what would you say about that?
I think the best quote I ever heard, and I can't remember the old lady's name, but she lived in a caravan on Dartmoor on her own with no electricity whatsoever. And she had a wood-burning stove in her caravan. And the BBC actually went down and did an interview with her. She'd been there for years. And when this reporter got there, it was like the middle of winter, and he got in and she said, well, I'll just go and get some wood. And she went outside and she picked up some twigs and a few little logs, and she came in, and it took her like 10 minutes to get the fire going. And she said, I'll just put the kettle on, we'll make you a coffee. And she made this reporter a cup of coffee. And he said, look, that's just taken you 20 minutes to get the fire going, to make a cup of coffee. Wouldn't you rather just live in a house where you can put a kettle on and it takes 3 minutes? And she said, well, it did take me like 20 minutes. But for you, it's going to take 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, for the next 40 years, just to live in that house and pay for the kettle. And I think that people don't see it. People don't get the fact that when you turn on your electric, you still got to go to work for 8, 9, 10 hours a day to get the money to pay your bills so that you can you can live in what you presume is luxury, right? Now, I've had lots of people up here at the cabin, right? And I have not had one come in and go, oh, I couldn't live like this. I've had everyone come in and go, I can't believe this place. And why can't they believe it? Because they think it might be like a shed in the woods. It's four bedrooms. My lounge is 20 foot by 25 foot, with a beautiful log-burning stove. My dining room kitchen is 20 foot by 25 foot. It's a huge place. It's wood-paneled and plastered and painted, exactly the same as your house. And I don't pay anything for it, apart from I buy some gas. And when I talk about how little I pay, over the summer period, the last 6 months, I got through two canisters of gas in 6 months. That's 140 quid. 6 months, £140. What did you pay in gas in the last half a year? I dare say it was more than 140.
Yeah. That's quite amazing to think about like that. I mean, do you think that people... I guess to a lot of people, they assume it must be difficult, and they assume that the results must be disappointing, because this is just something that is not you know, you don't see it on TV. It's not recommended as a lifestyle. I guess the reasons for that would be obvious. And we can perhaps get onto that later. The other two questions I want to ask. You said that you spent 2 years driving around the country looking for the right bit of land. What defines for you? What were you looking for? What were the criteria? What defined the right? How did you know you'd found the right bit of land?
Well, this is weird because when I started looking, I was looking at any land at all, like any land at all, right, where it would be possible. As it turned out, woodland, it is absolutely perfect for a number of reasons, right? But I wasn't specifically looking at woodland. I was just looking at land. And there were times I was nearly, like I said, after 2 years, like I was nearly trying to convince myself that maybe this plot is perfect. And it was only because I took my wife with me every time. She was like, "You're insane. Like, you can be seen from everywhere. Like, there's a nature reserve over there. There's a police station over there. Like, what are you doing?" But I just wanted it so bad that you kind of try to, and then you're like, "Yeah, you're right. This is not the right bit." When we found it, we both stood there, and I was like, "Well, I don't know." And she said, "This is the bit. This is the bit." And I was like, "Well, we'll have to think about it." And we went away. And I looked at another two plots. And then she said, "Can we go back to that other one?" And we went back. And she said, "This is it." And I was like, "Okay, I'm not going to argue." But if you're married, right, and you have a synergy with your wife, right, sometimes and then I started to look. Because I wasn't convinced to start with. And then I thought, "Well, how can I do this here?" And then I thought, "Well, actually, I could. And actually, it's a lovely place. And actually, while I've been driving hours in different directions, this was 10 minutes.
Yeah. 10 minutes. I remember you said that.
And I was like, "This is not only possible, but this is a godsend." But because it wasn't exactly what I was looking for at the time, like I said, I was just looking for land, and kind of in my head I had like a field with high hedges, and I thought, no one would be on, and that's kind of what I was looking for. And then this cropped up. It really was the wife who just came in it and just went, "This is it."
I'm just thinking it's funny if you had gone for a field covered, surrounded by hedges, you'd have to call your channel the fielder or the hedger or something like that.
The field pig or something. Yeah, I know. It's bonkers. But sometimes, you know, in life, I'm a firm believer that things just happen for a reason. And this place was here for us, which is why I found it, which is why I've got it. And I'll be honest with you, right? I've helped 5 so far, and I've got another 2 on the go. And these are individuals, not part of a group. These are individuals who, only through watching my channel, have said, "Man, I want to do that," and have done it. So that's 5 families who have now done this. And there's another 2 doing it. And I'm helping them as much as I can. And they're all okay. And they're all cool, man. But it's like, that's enough for me. Like, that is enough for me that someone has seen it's possible. And that's the only reason I did it. When you find out it's possible that you can do it, you go, "Fuck it. If someone else can do it, there's absolutely no reason I can't."
Yeah, your channel epitomizes what I've been saying the last few days about how it's much better to have an example to follow than someone just saying it in theory. It's, you know, if someone actually does the thing, then other people can see it really is possible. It really is, because he has actually done it. So that means I could do it. So it opens up possibilities. It opens up, people start thinking. So I'm not surprised, and I'm glad that other people have followed your example. So two other questions. You once said that you didn't actually, because people assume there must be a lot of work involved in it, and there also must be a lot of skills involved. So you must have known, I think people assume you must have known a huge range of skills before you started, but actually you've said that you knew very little about electrics and so on. Now, go for it.
Yeah, I knew nothing. In fact, before I did this, like my DIY skills were historically hysterical. Like, when I bought my first house, I had no idea how to get the curtains on the rail with those little hooks, and so I just nailed them up. I nailed them right across and then had them done with tie backs. And right. I remember my mum coming round to my first house and saying, "How did you put those curtains up?" And I said, "I just nailed them." And it's like, they laughed about that for years. And then another time, I tried to tile a kitchen. I'd never done tiling before. And I picked up from my dad's house what said on the tub, tile adhesive. But it wasn't tile adhesive in there, it was wallpaper paste. But I didn't know any different. So I was trying to put these tiles up in my kitchen with wallpaper paste. And then I went to bed that night and just heard all these tiles just falling and smashing on the floor. So, no, I like a builder, I am not. But I figured, okay, how do you do something like that then? And I typed into YouTube, of all things, how do you build a big shed? And I watched this bloke and I thought, okay, well, I can see how the framework's made. Let's stop it there. If I upscale that, so instead of building a frame 2 foot by 2 foot, if I build it 8 foot by 8 foot, and with 3-inch posts instead of 2x2s, I reckon I can just build that, but bigger. And it's pretty much what I did. And then I had a chat with some builders and said, listen, I can't dig down for foundations. And they said, well, just lay like 10 ton of hardcore, pat that down with a digger, and then lay a course of bricks or a course of concrete blocks out for your frame to sit on. I was like, will that be a work? And they were like, yeah, that'll be fine. So you listen to advice from people that know, and then you crack on with it. And as it went on, it became easier. And the same with the plumbing and the same with the wiring. Now, I had a plumber come in at the end and hook the pipes into the radiators and into the boiler. And I had an electrician come in to the end and fit the consumer unit and check everything. But I ran all the wires. Because I said to him, how much is it? And he said, well, I'm 250 quid a day. And I said, well, if I run all the wire, he said, you do that, I'll come and fit the thing. It'll only take me a day. He said, if you want me to fit the whole rest, it's going to take me 2 months. At £250 a day. I'm like, no, I'll do that. But it was like I had to drill 700 holes through roof beams and through the stud work to run the wires and fit. Get the sockets on, and it's hard. It's graft, but it's not complicated. It's donkey work, and you can do that if they. I was like, "What wire do I need? Just write it down. I'll go to Wix and buy it," and that's what I did.
It seems like this must have relied on a change in attitude as well. Because I can imagine when you were younger and you were tiling that floor, it sounds like you didn't bother to find out how to actually do it. You probably weren't trying, but whereas with this, you took it much more seriously, it sounds like.
It wasn't a floor, it was a wall with wallpaper paste.
Oh,
and you
sorry.
Imagine trying to put a tile on a wall with wallpaper paste, and the things were sliding down. So I was thinking, well, maybe if I start at the bottom. Yeah, but you've got to think, when I did that, there was no internet. So how would I have known? Apart from go and talk to a tiler who I didn't know any tilers. And I was like, I'm not going to phone my dad because I'm just going to be embarrassed now that I can't tile this wall. So I thought, if I start at the bottom and put the tiles one on top of it, then they can't slide down. And it was my dad's fault, I've got to be honest, because when I went round, I said, have you got any tile DC? And he said, yeah, there's a big tub in the shed in a white container. And what I took was a big tub in the shed that said tile adhesive, but was one he'd mixed wallpaper paste in about 3 months ago and kept it. And yeah, when I went round the next day, I was like, this wallpaper, this tile adhesive is absolutely shit. All my tiles broke. He was like, oh, fuck, you took the wrong one.
But I guess so it wasn't so much like you discovered a sense of agency. It was just that you went around, you were more careful. You said that when people visit the cabin, they're impressed by it. But surely you must have moments yourself where you're impressed by it as well. When you look around and think, fucking hell, I built this. Does that ever strike you? Do you ever have moments like that?
Yeah, a lot. Every morning when I open my bedroom door and look out into what is our dining area and kitchen, where we've got a kitchen table and we sit there in the morning, me and the wife, and we have coffee and we talk and we chat. And I just look at it and I just think, fucking hell. Like, it is literally, it's that nice. And to know that you did it, it is a good thing. The other thing that always strikes me is, right, this isn't just a cabin. It's a nice piece of land. It's beautiful. And this is something I can now leap. Right, this is a legacy. I have actually done this. And no matter what happens from now on, right, my kids will always be able to say, do you know what? My old man built that. Did yeah. that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. It's like a tangible thing that you've created and that you can leave in the world. Another question is about what are the limits of the structure, the cabin? Can it withstand like a hurricane, harsh weather, a thunderstorm? Are there any things that where you're lying in bed thinking, oh shit, I'm in trouble tonight, kind of thing?
Well, look, we've had trees down and trees down that have hit it, and it's stood up to that. Wind and that, it's not a problem. I mean, it's pretty damn sturdy. I mean, I've had builders up here now and have a look at it, and they've like, mate, you've nailed it. It's there's nothing wrong with it. It's not going anywhere. It can't fall down. It's spot on. And that's all good. The cabin itself is great. The nice thing is, if I want to make it a little bit bigger, I can just knock a wall out and build another bit. And I can just keep on going, which is brilliant. But we built it. We did this four-bedroom place because we thought two of the kids were going to come with us. And then one went off to university, and then one got a boyfriend and moved in with him. And now it's just me and my missus. And like, so I think that's why we've got 7 dogs and 5 cats and 120 chickens and whatever. Like, it's like we just filled it with something because we're rattling around in it. It's huge. But, you know, if they ever need to come here, they can. And they know that, which is brilliant.
Absolutely. Another question that's a wee bit different about practical work. Do you feel that, because, you know, there is this cliche about Gen X, your generation and mine, the millennials, probably the Zoomers as well to some extent, that a lot of our work is in cubicles, in offices, corporations, very sterile, and you're sitting at a computer all the time, do you think that, and you know, there is the link between that and depression and just low morale, low agency, low sense of who you are in the world and all this kind of stuff. Practical work. How does that, what would you say about, you know, going out and chopping wood compared to that?
You went to art college, yeah? Did you get into graphic design a bit afterward? Because it was kind of the thing in the 90s.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did that as a job, like, which was so dull, man. It was, if you're an artist, if you're into art, it was just the dullest thing. And in the end, I ended up throwing an iMac, a marketing manager, literally threw it at their head and walked out because I just couldn't do it anymore. And I went back to...
Did it stick? Did it stick? Yeah. Is the guy now walking around with an iMac?
Pretty much. Because it got to that point that I was just like so sick and tired of it that it didn't matter anymore anyway. And I went back to doing drawings and making very little money selling them. But it was what I wanted to do. I just wanted to do art. And then I bought a pub and ran a pub for a while. I did all these other things. But that environment of doing graphic design was kind of what you mentioned there, of working a cubicle, working in a call center, working in like sales, working in this boxed in thing where you get up in the morning and you have your coffee quickly, get in your car, drive to work, sit in your cubicle, do your job, get out, come home, watch EastEnders, go to bed, get up in the morning. Whoa! And then you come to the realization that you're suddenly 50 and you're like, what the fuck? Excuse my language again, but it's like...
I think I swore earlier, so does it...
It's like you do. You must wake up from that and just go, I'm not doing anything I wanted to do. My life is meaningless. And how that doesn't cause depression and anxiety, because you know that next day you're going to have to get up and do it again and you don't want to do it, and that causes anxiety and that will cause depression. And then we wonder why kids, and I'm talking 18, 20 year olds today, are looking at the future and thinking, what on earth is there for me? And they're all tech savvy, so they're hearing all this stuff from the Davos men about, you know, the fourth industrial revolution. You're going to have no jobs. You're going to be living in pods. You're going to have no money. And they're like, that's in one ear, and then in the other ear, they've got people telling them, you know, go out and do something with your life. And they're like, what? The cognitive dissonance and the anxiety and the depression that must be on these people today, like, I find it difficult to understand how they look forward and see a future for themselves. And it's a major problem.
And then there's a third aspect here. So you've got as you say, their parents and their teachers telling them, you've got to get a job, got to be useful to other people, you need money. And then they've got that, the technologists and the oligarchs saying you're going to have no money. But then a third thing is the pressure to be a celebrity. Because they've still got these film stars and singers who are, you know, incredibly rich. And that is still recommended as, you know, everyone wants to be, you know, every guy wants to be Brad Pitt. Every guy, and I don't know who it would be nowadays,
what they've said to young girls is, look, you can be famous. Just take your top off. Get an OnlyFans.
Yeah.
You can support your family. And you're seeing that more and more, that actually it's acceptable. You can support your family with this. And the amount of articles I've seen where it's actually not applauding it, but saying, you know, this teacher actually had an OnlyFans page and what of her children? And, you know, is this such a bad thing? And young girls see this, so they're like, okay, I'll just start taking my clothes off then.
Yeah.
That can't be right, can it?
I nearly did a thing about this, a monologue about this 6 months ago, because I realised, and this is a complete tangent, but we'll get back onto the real stuff in a minute. I realised, while that option, OnlyFans and whatever, is open to young women, there's not an equivalent for young men. So their option is to be a neat. You know, the young girl can sell her body online, and it's awful, of course. I'm not advocating that. But the young men are just screwed. They're just, well, I can just be an incel. I can be a neat. And I don't really know. See, this is to do with how utterly perverse our society is becoming, how dysgenic, dysfunctional. There are massive existential issues that need to be worked out in the future. And yeah, this is an example of one of them.
But it isn't by accident. But these things don't happen by accident. This is by design. And we kind of know this. And this goes back to what I said about politics, which was I learned and was told that all these groups were the same and that there's nothing but until you actually see it, until you... And get that kick in the bollocks, and you realise, fuck me, there is no difference. And this is the same, right? This thing has not just happened. It doesn't just happen that there's young girls taking their clothes off online and being paid for it by boys that used to date them or would like to date them, and that's the only interaction they're ever going to have with them. That's not an accident, right? That's been allowed to happen and has been pushed. Otherwise they'd stop it. Literally that. Otherwise they'd say, no, this is wrong, and it would be stopped, but it's not. And that's how you know it's on purpose.
Yeah, definitely it's been allowed to happen. I mean, I would ban, if I were a dictator, I would just ban OnlyFans. I think it's absolutely awful. And of course, to make it even worse, the young men paying these girls for this simulation of a relationship, they won't even be paying them with wages. The guys will be paying their UBI money in the future, or their welfare money, but probably UBI in the future. So, I mean, it's just so awful. And so this is, I guess that it does actually allow us to segue back to the real topic. This is why a lot of people, I think, in the future will want to escape from this, the mainstream, because the mainstream is going to be, already is, so perverse and wacko and unfulfilling. I mean, unfulfilling doesn't even cover it. It's possible to have a truly pathetic existence in the mainstream. And in some ways, as you said, the mainstream even pushes you towards that. It encourages that. So a lot of people are going to want something more fulfilling. And that's why I asked you about practical work and morale. That's how we got onto this, actually. You take it away.
Yeah. The hard work here, and it, sometimes I can think, oh, God. So I get up in the morning, feed the dogs, and I'll go out. And we split this between me and my wife, obviously. But a lot of the time I'll do it. So I'll get up and then I'll have to get a big bucket and I fill that full of like half one food, half corn. Then I'll go round and feed all the chickens and all the pens. I think we've got 9 pens. So that's 9 loads of food, which it doesn't take forever. Right, but it's a heavy bucket, and you know, it's first thing in the morning, and we're talking like sort of 8 o'clock. So you do that, and then I go back to the cabin, then I can sit down, then I can have a coffee. Now I've got 7 dogs to feed, and then feed 5 cats, and now I can go and get dressed and get ready for work. So that's the beginning, and most people don't do that. Most people roll out of bed, have a shower, get dressed, have a coffee, quick coffee. So I've got work to do. My wife's got work to do before we get to that stage, which is fine. I don't mind that. I quite enjoy it. Chopping wood. Before I moved here, I'd never chopped wood in my life. So now I've got to learn how to chop it. I've got to buy a good axe. I've got to learn how to use a chainsaw for a start. So I did all this stuff, and I learned how to use it, and I could chop up a branch into lumps of wood, and now I can split the wood with an axe. And sometimes my wife will watch me, and she thinks I look quite manly, and I'm covered in sweat and sawdust and wielding an axe, and she'll be calling me macho out the window. Taking a piss, obviously, but nevertheless.
Well, maybe not. You know, I heard that, and this is the strangest thing, I heard that chopping wood apparently exercises particular muscles that create a release of, cause a release of testosterone. So it's actually, apparently chopping wood is the thing to do if you want to increase your T level.
Without a doubt, right? It's not only good for a number of reasons, right? With a big axe, hitting something really hard and breaking it and splitting it and succeeding. So you've got success. You've got masculinity. You've got a weapon. You've got everything that's going for a male in one activity. Plus, you get an exercise. And at the end of it, you've got a bunch of stuff that you're actually going to use to heat your home, to warm your family. It's difficult to find a downside to it. And you've got a lot of blokes go, yeah, you know, I go to the gym free. Do you know what? Buy yourself a chainsaw, buy a good axe, right? 2 hours' time, not only would you have done the same workout, right, and cost you nothing, but you've also got a pile of wood, and if you don't need it because you ain't got a log burner, you can sell it for 120 quid. You're going to be quids in all the way round.
Yeah, what's not to like? That links me to another question. Why do you have 130 chickens? Because you said it's nine pens and that's right. Go on.
Because I have a wife that likes chickens. And anyone who's married will know it's, if you've got a happy wife, right, you've got a happy life. And she loves chickens and she likes all the different breeds. And all the stuff up here is rare breeds. And for a long time, for 4 years, 5 years now, I've been saying, what we should do is like breed these rare breeds and sell them like as eggs. And she's like, yeah, brilliant idea. They fetch good money. And then we keep them because you can't part with them, with any of them. So it just grows and then some die off and then the numbers stay the same. But who knows? One day maybe it will be a ongoing. I sell a lot of eggs. I've got orders for eggs coming out my ears. And this time of year, this is a weird thing. I don't know if you knew this, right? In winter, they tend to stop laying eggs. And I was like, why are they stopped laying? And they're like, well, because they're growing feathers. And I'm like, so? And they're like, well, the feathers are calcium and the eggs are calcium and they've only got enough to do one. And in the winter, they need to grow more feathers. So they grow more feathers, so they stop laying eggs. And I'm like, well, I wouldn't have even thought of that. But it's true, they do still lay, but not as often because they can't make the shell because all the calcium that they're producing goes into making extra feathers. So, yeah, it's weird. And you learn a lot about it. It's interesting.
Yeah. You sell the eggs from rare breeds. So does that do they fetch more money than regular eggs?
No, they could do. If I sold them as breeding eggs, they could sell. Here's the difference. So I sell a box of eggs. I sell them for, I can't remember now, was it £1.50 for a box of eggs or a pound, whatever. If I sold them as breeding eggs, as hatching eggs, I could sell them for like 30 quid. But she won't do it because she's like, no, they're not the right colours in there and they're not the right thing yet. And I'm like, well, get that bit sorted. She's like, yeah, maybe next year. So what happens is they breed and they hatch and then she goes, oh, they're so cute. We'll keep them instead. So we just end keeping them.
All right, okay. I guess we should probably be wrapping up because I've got the Fergan coming on in 23 minutes. Are there any other things that you would... Oh, yeah, that was definitely a question I wanted to ask. What things should people be aware of that probably wouldn't occur to them? Like, let's assume somebody is going to... wants to go off-grid. They're resolved to do that. What problems, hardships, things to solve do they need to be aware of that they probably wouldn't think of?
Again, it's a big one. Look, anyone who's watching this that really wants to know the ins and outs, contact me on Telegram at The Woodlander. I'll answer as much as I can. Here's the thing to remember. Anything that possibly could go wrong, yeah, that's going to go wrong. And really stupid stuff. I don't know if you saw the story I did about my battery, the first battery I bought.
Is that the one that exploded?
No, I bought a battery that weighed just over a ton. And I thought, that's okay. Don't worry about it. I got a mate to deliver it on his pickup. And then he got it to the woods. And we were like, how are we going to get it out of the pickup? Like, how do you... And no one had an idea, so I had to get a mate to come round who was a scaffolder and build a scaffold platform behind the pickup, and then we ratcheted it off, and it was on this thing. And I was like, but I need it 500 metres away behind my cabin. How are we going to move it? And it was literally, it took... But we didn't even think of it. We never thought of how we were going to move it. I just bought it. I thought, oh, that's brilliant. That's the battery sorted. Yeah, you just anything you're going to do, just think ahead, right? Because it can end in lots of broken machinery and it can end in your wife threatening to leave you, right? So, which you don't want, which happens regularly in this scenario, but eventually it calms down. It all calms down and everything's cool. I've got to say, Colin, listen, I know you need a break between these things, so we'll wrap this up. I would love to do another conversation with you because we got waylaid and we never got into half of it, but thank you so much for having me on, man.
As I said, and I'm not just saying this, it's the truth. When I discovered your channel, whenever it was, January, February, I was so annoyed that I hadn't discovered it a few months earlier because I thought this is exactly the kind of thing that I want to encourage people to do. It's just the same reason I have people on to talk about crypto. There's going to be someone else talking about homesteading, which is a wee bit different from what you're doing. But similar. I think it's a good idea. And so I wished that you could have been on last year. But all through this year, I've been watching your videos. And I know you've been listening to the Graham broadcast. And so we've had this tantric relationship all through this year.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
This is the first time, right, I've managed to get through a whole string without talking about the thing. Honestly, not once have we touched upon it. So again, thank you, because for me it's one of those prevalent things that everyone talks about all of the time. It always gets done. And tonight we didn't. We talked about art college. We talked about chickens. We talked about, but not once about the thank you.
Excellent. It was refreshing. All right. So thank you Woodlander for appearing on Millennial 2021. And all right, I'll be back in 20 minutes with the Fergan. And I'm really glad we did this stream. I've enjoyed it a lot. All right. Thank you. And hold on a minute. We didn't even do the bloody questions. Hold on. Let me just check. We can get that done really quickly. Woodlander, sorry. I'm really curious as to why this all happened. Does the leadership of the this is about the Conservative Party. Does the leadership intentionally select cowards? Could you answer that as briefly as you can?
Well, no. I think the leadership within the Conservative Party is chosen, not by the Conservative Party. It's nothing to do with them. Or the Labour Party, or the Liberal Party. They're all part of... They are merely puppets. And nowadays, they've actually shown themselves to be exactly what they are, which is puppets of a higher power.
Yeah. All right. I think that's true. I think all of the parties are just puppetry at this point. Winter Phoenix, Forest Kirin. That was from him. Yeah. What do you make of the fractured state of the right? Reclaim, reform, UKIP, For Britain, Britain First, etc. And Patriotic Alternative would be another one. For those of us fed up with the culturally Marxist Tories, where do we go?
Yeah, well, that's... The right's been the same forever. Now, I've been involved for 40 years, so I could tell you that that was exactly the same with the British movement and the National Front and the 20 splinter groups from that, and then the BNP and then Combat 18 and Blood and Honour and all of these other groups that all split off. It's never been any different. The right has a major problem with uniting. It's not, and here's the thing, it isn't going to happen. They're not going to unite under one banner. It'd be lovely, but it's not going to happen. And I came to that conclusion yonks and yonks ago. So you either pick one who you think's going to be the biggest and hope to God that they're going to get big enough. No, I'm sorry. The splits and division have been there since the 30s when they began. So it's not much problem.
I think another problem, I mean, there are various things that could be said here. I think another problem is that each one enjoys the hope that they will be top dog one day. So they don't want to compromise with others. They don't want to merge with others. And then the other thing is that these different groups do have different perspectives that these issues haven't been resolved.
It's to do with the mentality and the character of a lot of the males that are attracted to the right wing, who are very confident, very assured of themselves, and believe that they are right. And these are the people we need, right? But when you get two of those, like, no one's going to give in. No one's backing down. Right? No one's going to join someone else's group. They want them to join theirs. And it's a problem when you have confident, assured males, alpha males. Two alpha males, it's difficult to get compromise. And the right wing attracts alpha males.
Well, yeah, yeah. It's also a problem with sociopaths, of course, who are more concerned with their own power seeking than with actually improving the world in any way. but anyway, yeah, you get seen well-balanced guys as well who just want to be top dog. And it's understandable. It's a very male drive. I don't know. I think that there's a certain thing about you can stand competition when there is actually when the environment can sustain it. But when there isn't a marketplace, then competition is just self-defeating. It just ensures that nobody wins. Okay, my thanks and respect to you both. Thank you very much. I can never pronounce your name. I think it's Dianique's Ghost. So thank you for that. Padfa, who's a friend of both yours and mine. Great to see you, Woodlander. I agree about technology. The problem is not technology, but our attitude to it and being disciplined. Great millennial woes marching on. Thank you very much. That's nice to see from Padfa. And Woes, thank you for what you do. I'm sorry for always complimenting your guests and neglecting to express my appreciation for you. Thank you, Luke. That's very kind. And also, finally, someone says, No Chance says, the Woodlander is the man. There you go. And an anonymous Paychad says, in some EU countries, you can't get planning permission to build a home in a low population density area. They're using climate change as an excuse to prevent building homes outside towns and cities. It's called cluster living. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Well, I will briefly. I never got planning permission. This is why we ought to do another one of these, really. Right? I never got planning permission. There's there's an English law, which is the four-year rule, which says if an Englishman builds a home, lives in it for 4 years, it's immune from enforcement. You can't take it down. It's now his home. It can't be touched. That's a very English thing. And I agree with it. I agree with that. Because if they complain or if people say, you can't have that, you can't be doing that within those 4 years, understandable, there's a complaint. But if nobody's complained and no one's asked you to take it down, it's obviously okay and you can have it. And that's the route I took. So it doesn't need planning permission.
All right. I think maybe we probably should do a stream at some point just with about nothing but this, about the process of setting up a cabin and going off grid. But I think we've touched on a lot of things here. So I think this has been an interesting stream. I'm sure people will have benefited from it. Let me just see if there are any other questions. I don't think there will be. Yeah, that's it. Okay. All right. So, okay. Thank you, Woodlander. I'm going to end this one now and I'll get 10
Thank
minutes
you.
Off. Okay. All right. I'll be back in 10 minutes with the Fergan. In the meantime, this has been a really good stream. Thank you. It's a long time coming. And all right. I'll see you soon.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.